Are appeals to federal politicians to reduce military spending, to get out of NATO and withdraw Canadian forces falling on deaf political ears? How can politicians respond favorably to individuals in the peace movement's questions when it contradicts what the media says about the war in Ukraine and in Gaza? Will the United States launch war on Iran over their refusal to agree to a nuclear deal on President Trump's terms? How might Iran fight back, and what if Russia joins in on Iran's side? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with politicians everywhere calling for increased spending on the military, and we now standing at the cusp of an even larger Middle East war about to break out soon, we are trying to assess where we may be headed. In our first half hour, we have a talk with Ken Stone of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War about his group's appeals for peace during the federal election. And then in our second half hour, Larry Johnson, a former CIA officer and intelligence analyst, offers his thoughts about the tensions between the U.S. and Iran, finally exploding into a major military attack in the not-too-distant future. On this week's program, Iran in the crosshairs, avoiding war, the start of World War III? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 4th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We acknowledge the bounty of the gifts and athesets of the land, and that the settlers received these benefits through broken treaties, false promises, and lies to the indigenous people of the land. The descendants should understand this historical imbalance so that we may all restore equity through reconciliation and reparations and return relations between the two peoples with mutual respect and partnership in the years to come. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. This is essentially a U.S. base. Trump wants to reduce military costs, and this is a large military base expensive to maintain, said Chasudovsky, author of numerous books, including The U.S. and NATO Aggression Against Yugoslavia and The Globalization of Poverty, which have been translated into Serbian. Regarding negotiations on Ukraine, Chasudovsky believes it would have been better if they had taken place in Belgrade, given that Serbia is a militarily neutral country. President Aleksandar Vučić could have played a mediating role, since he maintains dialogue with the EU, Washington, and Moscow. Chasudovsky emphasized to Tanjug that in the case of the bombing of the FRY, the propaganda machine was well organized, but that war was brutal and ruthless, planned many years in advance, quote, which is confirmed, among other things, by the construction of the American Bondsteel military base on occupied Kosovo, unquote, which, in his view, many see as a strategic pillar of the U.S. presence in this region. That comes from the article, Calls on Serbs to React, Time to Demand the Closure of the Bondsteel Military Base in Kosovo, Michel Chasudovsky, by Serbian Times and Professor Michel Chasudovsky, posted April 3rd, originally published on Serbian Times. U.S. President Donald Trump himself has warned that his country could, quote, launch a bombing attack the likes of which they have never seen before, unquote, if Tehran refuses to engage in negotiations and make the quote-unquote necessary concessions on its nuclear program. If they don't make a deal, there will be bombing, he said, adding that, quote, U.S. and Iranian officials are talking, unquote, and that, quote, there's a chance that if they don't make a deal, that I will do secondary tariffs on them like I did 4 years ago, unquote. Trump made the statement in an interview on March 29th, following the deployment of at least seven B-2, quote-unquote, Spirit strategic stealth bombers to the Diego Garcia Naval Support Facility, officially belongs to the British military, but leased to the U.S. Navy, and also often used by the USAF. The Pentagon operates only 19 B-2s, meaning that over a third of all operational bombers have been deployed to Diego Garcia. Such a high concentration of these aircraft is certainly not reassuring if one is to maintain peace. That comes from the article, U.S. Attack on Iran Imminent, by Drago Busnik, posted April 2nd, originally published on InfoBricks. The modern healthcare system is failing at its most basic function, preventing disease and promoting health. Chronic illness has become the norm in the Western world, and despite decades of technical advancements, rates of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and autoimmune disorders continue to climb. The United States spends more on healthcare than any other nation, over $4.5 trillion annually, yet its health outcomes rank among the worst. The leading causes of death are largely preventable and most share common risk factors, specifically poor diet, metabolic dysfunction, chronic inflammation, and exposure to environmental toxins. Despite this, the healthcare system remains fixated on expensive treatments rather than tackling the root causes. That comes from the article, By the Numbers, The State of America's Health Today, by Dr. Joseph Mercola, posted April 2nd, originally published on the Mercola website. Author and researcher Jacob Nordengard joins James to discuss his new article, Externalization of the Money Masters, which provides a very different take on the rise to power of Mark Carney. From Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy to Alice Bailey and the Externalization of the Hierarchy to Nordengard and Temple of Solomon, you won't want to miss this fascinating exploration of the occult roots of the globalist agenda. That was the introduction to the video under the headline, The Corbett Report, The Externalization of the Money Masters with Jacob Nordengard, by Jacob Nordengard and James Corbett, posted April 2nd, originally published on The Corbett Report. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network put out an advisory to the media this past Monday, which encapsulates their views that as members of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, they are not pursuing independent Canadian foreign policy and jeopardizing millions with wars for the military prospects of the few big military giants in the West. Such endeavors have proceeded in large part by virtue of the ignorance of much of the public fostered by the mainstream media to what is really going on abroad. Now, with the Canadian federal election underway, we will examine in more detail the policies and campaigns embraced by activists for peace across the nation until Election Day, April 28th, 2025. Ken Stone is with me now. He is a member of the CWPJN Coordinating Committee in Hamilton, Ontario. He's also the treasurer of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Always a pleasure to have you with back with us, Glenn, Ken, and welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
My pleasure, Michael.
So, just on some of the principal points you raised, first for one thing, in your statement in the advisory, you mentioned that Prime Minister Mark Carney should not raise defense spending to the levels he had indicated. As I understand it, all the competitive parties running for office intend to spend more money on the military, including the NDP and the Greens. Is your position that we should actually reduce spending on the military?
Absolutely. Canadians are not served well by military spending. In fact, our security as Canadians is better assured by non-military spending. For example, Canadians would be much better served in this context of environmental chaos by water bombers rather than F-35 fighter jets. Now, those F-35 fighter jets are designed to fight alongside the US in foreign wars of aggression around the world. And that's been Canada's role in NATO in vis-a-vis Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and so on. So it makes a lot more sense to have water bombers than F-35 jets. And moreover, there is a continuing health crisis in Canada and underfunding of health related expenses altogether, hospitals, nurses, doctors, everything. And as this health crisis continues to unfold and new diseases come back like measles and so on, it's much more important for Canadians to have hospitals with emergency wards that stay open 24/7 than it is to have the latest state-of-the-art destroyers that will be have to be purchased from the US once again, plying the Straits of Taiwan halfway around the world. It doesn't make any sense at all, actually. It's if Canadians reduce military spending and use that money for our social programs, infrastructure, environmental mitigation, we'd be a lot more secure. But that's not what our federal government is talking about. When he came back from, when he got off the call, sorry, a Zoom call with the so-called coalition of the willing European countries who want to have put a reassurance force into Ukraine, the first thing that Carney said, and this was on his first day as Prime Minister of Canada, was that we should expect unprecedented rises in the in military spending. And that, in my view, is a great mistake. And it's really sad that none of the opposition parties are taking issue with this remark.
Yeah, just on a side point there, you also mentioned that in terms of jobs, military spending is not going to bring you the same number of jobs as spending on housing, education, and healthcare, based on st many studies. I mean, could you just give me an example of one of those studies and like how much you they would how much more of a bargain you might say in terms of jobs that the housing, the social programs are as opposed to the military?
Well, I don't have my finger on any particular study right now, and that's my fault. I apologize, Michael, and to your readers, listeners. But there have been many studies over the years by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and many other groups, peace groups across the country, that have found that for every dollar that it's invested in the military, you get much fewer spin-off jobs that created in the economy than if you spent the same amount of money on education, healthcare, infrastructure, environmental mitigation, or any other subjects. Because very simply, the money that's put into planes and tanks and warships and drones is money that is frozen into something that's totally unproductive. For example, if you buy US fighter jets, the F-35s with a price tag of $19 billion, but which actually have a lifetime cost of $74 billion, then that money is locked into machines of war which do not produce anything. Whereas money put into housing or into healthcare, for example, is put into products and services that generate more economic activity in Canada rather than being frozen into a weapon of war. So, for every, if you want the biggest bang for your buck in job creation, it's been shown around the world and in studies in Canada that your best bang for the buck is into social programs, infrastructure, environmental mitigation, and not military spending.
Another statement to the public that you made was that that the Canadian military officers should be withdrawn from Bahrain, where they're helping to coordinate and participate in Operation Prosperity Guardian in bombing Yemen. Now that puts us in tune with the news of the day in Yemen, because a lot of people don't know that we are helping to participate in strikes against civilians. And you also called for Canadian troops, warplanes, and warships to be withdrawn from Latvia, from Romania, and the Straits of Taiwan. I'm wondering, do you oppose all military deployments in the world, or do you oppose those specific areas? And if it's that latter, I mean, what do they have in common that you are pushing back against?
I'm pushing back against them. We are pushing back against them because these have nothing to do with peace or peacekeeping. These are part of Canada's role in NATO, in specifically in when we talk about the, I think it's 700 troops that we have in Latvia and a number of fighter jets we have in Romania. It's part of our usual role as a junior partner in U.S. foreign policy that we continue to practice gunboat diplomacy along with the USA and other of its allies and client states off the coasts of of Asia, specifically in the Taiwan Straits and along the coast of North Korea. Canada has no mandate whatsoever for being in the Straits of Taiwan and on the coast of North Korea. These are missions that are taken outside of the structure of the United Nations, and frankly, they are flagrant aggressive moves designed to threaten China and North Korea. And I note, the peace movement notes that there are no Chinese ships off Vancouver Island or in the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and there are no North Korean vessels off either the west or east coast of Canada. So what we are doing is typical neo-colonial gunboat diplomacy, and there is no justification for it. And believe me, it's not cheap. Justin Trudeau, when he established the policy of sending Canadian ships into the Straits of Taiwan and in North Korea, estimated the cost would be $500 million. And I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 years. It's not cheap. $500 million would go a long way to alleviating the homelessness crisis in Canada, or any of the other major crises we face, including the lack of drinking water for Native people on northern reserves. So it's a flagrant misappropriation of funds, and it doesn't do anything for Canada except line us up in the US camp while the US government, the US administration of Donald Trump, is threatening to. Is it not threatening anymore? They're tariffing Canada, if I can use that as a word, And they're Trump is threatening to annex Canada. So if we are being threatened by being taken over by the US, why are we still cooperating on all these military adventures against China, against North Korea, against Russia, instead of starting to think about developing an independent foreign policy outside of NATO?
Yeah, okay. So independent foreign policy outside of NATO and committed to peace and nuclear disarmament and cooperation with countries. I know this show's typically focused on that pretty much every week. But I imagine any politician, I mean they say they do support these principles, right? But the thing is that there's the problem is that most people out there at the door, they aren't believing in the suppositions of the questions. I mean, the media and all our politicians, I mean, they say Russia bad, Ukraine good, right? I mean, and I mean, for example, and so I wonder how can we expect politicians to react any way but dismissively against these sorts of questions? Because that really that tends to put them on the outside of public opinion. You understand what I'm saying there.
I think that what makes politicians move is numbers of pe people in the streets, as people have done to support the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. It means that people have to be lobbying their politicians. They have to be on social media. They have to make their voices heard. Then the politicians start to listen. And I think that if people started to talk to their politicians clearly and say to them, and this was the key point of the media advisory, don't send any Canadian troops into Ukraine as peace, a so-called reassurance force, or as peace, so-called peacekeepers, because it's not about reassurance, it's not about peacekeeping. What the talk that Mark Carney and Bill Blair about Canada being ready and willing to send troops into Ukraine means is that we are continuing not to look to seek for a ceasefire and a peace a deal that would end the war, but rather to keep the war going. And by putting Canadian and European troops into Ukraine, we are actually provoking, we would be provoking Russia, who's already said it's a red line, and they would attack any such troops. So we are actually setting ourselves up to get into even a bigger conflict with Russia over Ukraine at a just at a time when the hegemon, that is to say the dominant power in the West, the USA, of course, is talking about winding down the war and has actually started talks with Russia after 3 years almost, more than 3 years actually, 3 years of having no talks, no negotiation, no diplomacy. Canada's role, along with the Europeans, in threatening to place troops inside of Ukraine following a 30-day ceasefire or any kind of ceasefire of that respect is actually a very great escalation of the conflict. And Canadians should not allow that to happen. They should be on the phones to their MPs. They should be, lobbying MP, visiting their MPs. They should be out on the street. And that's what our Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network actually plans to do. If the Canadian government actually goes forward and decides to send troops to Ukraine, we will organize cross-Canada demonstrations and rallies and hope that people join them.
Is there one specific policy proposal you have in mind during this election that if people get anything to a candidate's ear, this is what it should be? I mean, is there anything in particular that you'd like to emphasize?
Well, I think that the two things are on our plate, really, and as priorities. One is end Canada's role of enabler of the genocide in Gaza and the West Bank. The Canadian government could do a whole bunch of things without waiting for the United Nations to act in order to show Israel that we are not happy about what it's doing there. And these things are very simple. We could simply suspend diplomatic relations, suspend the Canada-Israel security and free trade agreements. We could end charitable donations that are raised in Canada for the state of Israel. We could institute a two-way arms embargo on Israel and Canadian arms. We could do a whole bunch of things. So that's one priority, to send to Israel a message to stop the genocide, which Canada has so far failed to do. The other thing on our plate is that Canada needs to develop an independent foreign policy, especially at a time when we are under attack by the USA. And this foreign policy should put into question. And finally, it is. People are starting, it's on the table. People are talking about it. Why are we spending this money and staying in NATO when we are under attack by the Americans? Why should we stay in NORAD? Why the North American Air Defense, that's NORAD, and it's very costly. About $40 billion is projected. And at the same time, even Carney has felt the pressure and has called into question the purchase of the F-35 fighter jets. So all these things are now on the table, I'm hoping that Canadians will deliver a message during this election using our election signs, using the suggested questions for candidates, referring to our media advisory. I'm expecting that all those things will be on our website soon, the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network.
Okay, and finally, are there any political candidates or political parties that you're prepared to endorse?
The Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network is nonpartisan, so we are not endorsing any particular party, but any candidates who have opposed the genocide in Gaza, such as Matthew Green here in Hamilton, we would suggest people find such candidates in their own ridings if they exist and try and help to get them reelected. And we would also, support any candidates who would support the idea after two or three decades when Canadians haven't had a chance to discuss foreign policy, to call for a green paper on foreign policy to be issued by the Canadian government. A green paper means a discussion paper inviting comments from Canadians across the country. And I'm sure that there would be a lot of comments from Canadians across the country asking for the Canadian government to get out of NATO and NORAD and to develop an independent foreign policy based on peace and cooperation with all the countries of the world.
Ken Stone, it's been a treat having you back. Take care, and we'll see you again after the election, okay?
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Michael.
We've been speaking with Ken Stone, the treasurer for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and a coordinator of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Both the U.S. and Israel have expressed concern repeatedly about Iran's nuclear program and the possibility of obtaining the ability to develop a nuclear bomb. Iran repeatedly says they only want the technology for peaceful purposes. Then on Sunday, President Trump blurted out in a television interview, and that, and this is a direct quote, "If they don't make a deal, there will be bombing." and it will be bombing the likes of which they have never seen before, unquote. In a letter written to the UN Security Council by Iranian UN Ambassador Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran condemned President Trump's statement and vowed retaliation if attacked. In the late March, according to satellite pictures taken this Wednesday by Planet Labs and verified by Associated Press, the U.S. deployed at least six B-2 Spirit strategic health bombers, close to a third of the nation's supply of the bombers, to the Diego Garcia Naval Support Facility on an island in the Indian Ocean, strategically placed to strike targets all over the Middle East. Is the United States about to go to war with Iran? Joining us to discuss this question and what it might lead to is Larry Johnson. Larry C. Johnson is a former CIA officer and intelligence analyst and former planner and advisor at the U.S. State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He appears regularly on various news sites, video blogs, and independent online channels, including Sputnik, RT, Judging Freedom, Redacted, Iran, and many others, including Global Research NewsHour. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour, Larry.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
So, Larry, it seems like this episode is somewhat reminiscent of the war in Iraq, like the prospects of waging war on Iran. It was illegal, but the Security Council did not approve it, and there is nothing indicating Iran is threatening America or anything else. Just the principal stated reason for launching the war being the prospects of weapons of mass destruction. The smoking gun could turn out to be a mushroom cloud, as with the Iraq war. But what do you believe is the real reason they seem to want to attack Iran?
I think it's there's two aspects to it. One is the sort of the control that the Zionists, and it's not just Jewish, it's Christian Zionists as well, have over the Trump administration, where they have persuaded themselves that the nation of Israel has been chosen by God and that we must do everything in our power to defend and protect Israel, regardless of whether it serves the interests of the United States or not. So that's number one. Number two, sort of, I think there's a broader strategic objective, wanting to destroy Iran and the current leadership, to take it out of any possibility of being in the Russian sphere of influence. Because Russia and Iran have been working for a bit, and that work is now poised to accelerate on building a north-south transportation corridor. That corridor would run from the Arabian Sea and then the mouth of the Persian Gulf. There are two separate ports. Then from those ports, we're using railroad lines that go all the way up into the Caspian Sea, and then through the Caspian Sea, transporting the goods into Russia.
So do you think is a possibility, because I know that Iran,
the current positions, I mean, but Russia is looking at it in terms of its ability to move grain, fertilizer in and out of Russia is right now heavily dependent upon passage through the Black Sea, going through the Dardanelles into the Mediterranean, and then if it goes to Asia, having to go through the Suez Canal. Well, the West can easily shut those down and in a way bottle up Russia. So Russia for a long while has been looking for an alternative route that goes through Iran. And so this, both Iran's status as a new member of BRICS, now this is part of what I'd call a longer term Russian strategy to completely divorce itself from the Western economy, from any dependency whatsoever on U.S. dollars as a dollar reserve currency.
Do you think there's a, I mean, I hear that Iran is, I mean, it's not a pushover exactly. I mean, I think I mean, not like, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. I mean, these were, fairly weak countries compared to Iran, maybe the most powerful enemy apart from Russia that the United States would seem to go against. I mean, they know that. So, I mean, is there a possibility that there's a like a blinking contest between the two of them to see, well, are they going to scare Iran, with a bluff, so to speak, or I mean,
Yeah.
and surrender a nuclear program or something else?
Yeah, the danger we face right now is not just the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself and his national security team with Marco Rubio, Michael Waltz, Pete Hegseth, John Ratcliffe, and I'm sad to say even Tulsi Gabbard have bought into the nonsense, apparently, that Iran has been tremendously weakened by the October 27th air attack, missile attack by Israel. And they've also ignored the Iran's attack on Israel 1st of October, which was in retaliation for Israel's murder of both a Hamas negotiator in Tehran, as well as assassinations of other top Iranian military officials. So there has been that tit for tat. But in the October 1st attack, Iran, it was a demonstration attack. In other words, Iran was not trying to destroy Israel. It was sending Israel a message that if you don't back off and change your conduct, we can do tremendous damage to you. And they revealed, demonstrated that they have hypersonic missiles that are capable of changing course in flight to the target. In other words, in the videos that emerged, you could see an inbound Iranian missile. It's coming down at about an angle going traveling from, say, 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock on a clock face. And you see a missile, an air defense missile from Israel coming up. And that missile from Iran suddenly does a nosedive to 6 o'clock position, goes down, then comes back out at the eight, pointing to eight. I mean, it clearly evaded that missile. And Iran claimed to have hit a key Israeli military base. The Israelis said, oh, no, they didn't do any damage. But the video actually that emerged online showed a number of significant hits on that base. So then on October 27th, Israel claimed, oh, my God, we hit every base in Iran. We wiped out their air defense. And yet, the information that was available online with video taken from the ground showed that Iran intercepted the vast majority of the missiles that Israel fired. So right now, you've got the West pushing a lie and believing a lie that Iran is naked in terms of its defense capability, and that we can easily go in and just, bomb them, like Trump said. Oh, they'll never seen anything like it. Well, there's one other change in this equation, and that is Iran's military relationship with Russia. So we know that for the last 7 years, Iran has been conducting annual joint naval military exercises with Russia and with China together. So it's been a triad of joint exercises,
Yeah. Well, I.
and that started in 2019. So my point in this is that the nature of the agreement between Iran and Russia is such that any attack, unprovoked attack by the United States and or Israel, will bring the Russians in on the side of Iran.
Yeah. I know that. In your in an interview with Scott, there was a conversation with Scott Ritter, and he was talking about taking Iran out of the picture, that the whole Middle East would be destabilized, and maybe Trump and Netanyahu want Israel to be the lone power in the region or something like that. And Ritter thinks he that it would be bad for America, but I mean, what do you think of this point? I mean, how would the Middle East be exactly would the Middle East be destabilized in the wake of an absent Iran?
Well, number one, it precedes, let's say, the Western attack, the Western plan to take out the Iranian regime is based on the premise that we can install a new government in Iran that will be more amenable to cooperating with the United States and will actually be more hostile to Russia and to China. That's what we're banking on. Now, where are we going to find those magical people? It is we've got now a history of over the last 70 years of repeated military interventions where we've replaced the existing governments with the anticipation that the succeeding government will, bring magical solutions. Well, we saw how that worked out even in Panama, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, Syria now. And so this is one more example of Western hubris, in my view. This, I think that really. U.S. desires to replace, destabilize the government of Iran, I think will backfire. I think we'll see the government of Iran actually strengthened if the United States decides to go forward with this attack. And it's going to, up to this point, that they've sort of aligned themselves with the West, thinking that the West is more powerful and stronger than it really is. That'll be the revelation. If the United States launches these air assaults and fails, that in fact Iran is able to defeat it, shoot down a number of US aircraft, and prevent any of the inbound missiles from hitting their target, the rest of those governments are going to step back and go, "Oh, wait a second." It's like you're betting on a cage fighter. You think this guy's the best fighter in the world. And then he goes into the ring and get that ring and gets beaten. All of a sudden, you're not as confident about, hey, I'm gonna bet all my money on this guy.
We're talking about the prospects of a possible, increasingly probable war with Iran in the not too distant future. Larry, given the way the U.S. is building forces in the Gulf, I mean the Diego Garcia, the bombers and the Diego Garcia, for example, being deployed. What kind of a time period are we looking for? Before an attack takes place, I mean, couple,
Probably 4 weeks,
4 weeks, eh?
four to 6 weeks. Now, the last 24 or 36 hours, there has been one development. Initially, Iran completely rejected the U.S., Trump's letter saying, "Hey, let's negotiate," because Trump's letter wasn't just, "Hey, let's talk." It was, "Yeah, we'll talk, but you got to number one, promise that you're not going to provide any more support to Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Yemenis, and that you're going to, it was levying a bunch of requirements that Iran just said, no, we're not going to disarm ourselves. We'll sit down and talk to you, as a peer country talks to a peer country. There's got to be some respect here." So now it looks like Iran is open to talking via a mediator, having a third party, perhaps the folks out of Oman, or the folks out of Dubai or Qatar. Those are three places within the Persian Gulf that they could be amenable. So if they start talking, then that's that will get a process underway. And frankly, this is one of those elements of that agreement that Iran and Russia signed, where Russia would work with and on behalf of Iran through diplomatic channels as well to defuse threats in the region. So I think Trump's got a lot really at risk if he opts for the military strategy vis-a-vis Iran. It sounds makes good sound bites for television. Be terrible from a policy standpoint, and I think it will expose, if you will, the weakness of the U.S. military, not its competence.
Well, why don't you build on that? I mean, what kind of damage does the United States risk? How exactly is Iran expected to retaliate? You did bombing U.S. bases in the region, bombing Israel itself?
No, the depending upon the types of targets that the U.S. hits in Iran, assuming that the attack comes off, Iran's in a position to hit, we've got an estimated 50,000 American troops scattered in bases from, Al Udeid, which is in Qatar. You've got a naval base, naval facility in Bahrain. You've got other bases there in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So, Iran could hit those. There's also bases in Syria and Iraq, in Western Iraq anyway. Then on top of that, if there are any attacks on the oil infrastructure of Iran, then that would they would shut down the Gulf. And so you would be deprived of all the oil out of the Persian Gulf, including Iranian oil, which would send a massive shockwave through the international oil market. It'd be good news for Russia because, there'd be greater demand for their product, even though it's being sanctioned. So this would be terribly, terribly dangerous, just from an economic standpoint. If the U.S. is assuming that it can keep complete control of the process and limit the damage, I maintain that is a wrong-headed, dangerous assumption. It's more likely to go just in the opposite direction, where we lose control and we suffer the damage.
You don't anticipate any U.S. troops actually being dispatched on the ground, do you?
No, that'd be suicidal.
Yeah.
Look at the size, look at the trouble we had quelling unrest in Iraq after our, mission accomplished day. Okay. We were there for another 15 years and never really got it settled down. Iran is four times the size of Iraq in terms of land mass. It also has a larger population. So, and the nature of the terrain, a lot of mountainous areas in the northern part of Iran, it makes it very difficult to, troops on the ground to control. So no, we, if we were going to quote invade Iran to somehow secure it, we'd need probably a 2 to 3 million man army. Our current army is 450,000, 470,000. We're not even anywhere in the ballpark. And that's our total global commitment, force commitment.
And for Iran, I mean, what kind of damage would the weapons be able to do on Iran?
They've moved a lot of it underground. So, I don't think there's a lot of Iran has not put its most sensitive, important assets above ground. So it would be, and the United States would have to figure out how to try to hit them. Now they're talking about bunker buster bombs, but even as we've seen in Yemen, they've been of limited effect, which then raises the specter, and I think Scott Ritter talked about this, of the United States using tactical nuclear weapons against Iran. I know that's within our, toolbox of capabilities, but doing that, I think, would bring Iran, Russia, and China into the battle. And this is how, just as in World War One, the assassination of the Archduke of Austria by a Serbian nationalist all of a sudden got the Russia, the French, and the Brits on one side lined up against the Germans, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Italians and the Turks on the other side. And it just went off, and started killing each other. We could face that kind of scenario here where all of a sudden any attack on Iran is going to be responded to with support direct from Russia. And Russia's not waiting until an attack occurs. There's already intelligence sharing. There's already the provision of military equipment that is be critical for defeating inbound missiles, things including like electronic warfare capabilities, as well as air defense systems, such as the S-400, S-500 potentially. So this is, I said, this is the dangerous game that Trump is playing. And he's not going to be able to bully the Iranians into doing what Trump is claiming. But more important than that, Trump is he's lying about the status of Iran's nuclear program. Even this the defense of national the director of national intelligence now, Tulsi Gabbard, her office released a report a week ago Monday that was a detailed the assessment of the threat assessment in the region. It says specifically that Iran is not building or trying to procure a nuclear weapon. On top of that, that agreement that Iran signed with Russia on January 17th explicitly commits Iran to work with Russia on non-proliferation. Well, if they were building a nuclear weapon, a nuclear warhead, that would be proliferation. That would be a violation of that agreement that they have in place with Russia. I don't think Iran's crazy. They're not gonna take a reckless action and risk alienating Russia because Russia provides a big security umbrella for them.
Well, Russia, I guess, signed the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Treaty with the Islamic Republic of Iran in just in January 17th of this year. So if the US attacks Iran, then that suggests, in your mind, I guess in writing, that they are bound to enter into the fray, right? Does that, I mean, are we talking about World War III here?
No, we are. That's how this could erupt into World War III. Again, it's guided by false assumptions. And the assumption on the part of the Trump administration is that Russia will not get involved and that the United States can basically do what it wants without any repercussions. And it also assumes that Iran doesn't have much capability of punching back. If either of those assumptions are wrong, and we are into World War III.
Would it mean like launching nukes right away, or Russia? How would they get intersect in the in the dispute, so to speak?
Well, I
Any
think the
idea?
first it depends. If the United States used a nuke, then all of a sudden, I think. Russia would see, would probably have to act preemptively against the United States. The United States has already been carrying out military attacks inside Russia. They admitted that as in this article that appeared on Monday of this week by Adam Entus at the New York Times. So this if this moves to war, the first thing that's going to happen, the Russians will take out U.S. satellites. And Elon Musk could probably say goodbye to his Starlink system. So it's going to be the West is going to experience a bit of a blackout. And then, Russia is in a position to do a lot more damage to us than we are to them, despite our claims otherwise.
Yeah. Well, could you just say then, I mean, is there like when will we have reached the point of no return where they're going to go for it, or say, well, there's still a time chance that they could back down, or we have we passed that point?
We are, I don't know if you're familiar with with firearms, but there's the expression of a hair trigger.
Oh my.
And the hair trigger means that when you just apply the least little bit of pressure, sometimes even touching the trigger, just literally not pushing on it, just literally touch it, it can actually release the hammer and the firing pin will strike the cartridge. The gun will go off. I think that we're in that kind of situation right now. This deployment of the B-2s and the B-52s to Diego Garcia, I think is in part initially a bargaining ploy by Trump to, a way to threaten without directly saying so, hoping that that will intimidate the Iranians, but it's not. But then Trump's going to also, his team will find out that some of the maintenance issues that the B-2 bombers face are so significant that they may have trouble getting them up into the air after two or three missions. So, the United States on paper, boy, we look like we're really strong and really powerful. But then, as we've seen with this confrontation with Yemen, are the Harry S. Truman, the aircraft carrier, and the carrier strike group, which means that carrier is accompanied by at least two destroyers and a cruiser. They find that they've got limited power, that no matter how many bombs they drop on the Yemenis are still capable of firing missiles back. So, any hope that this is a quick solution goes away. And then if we find ourselves in the position of launching, missiles that cost $1 million, $2 million at drones that are preparing to attack our ship that cost only $5,000 to $10,000. Well, we'll go bankrupt before the Yemenis do.
Larry, I want to thank you for coming on the show just at the last minute and agreeing to questioning for me about these very disturbing developments. We really appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Michael.
We've been listening to Larry Johnson, the former CIA analyst, officer, and intelligence analyst, and a commentator on U.S. foreign policy. Be sure to check out all his fantastic work at sonar21.com. That's our show for this week. Next week, we look at the genocide currently taking place in Syria. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.